But Alex didn't even have to think. He knew what to do, as if he had done it a dozen times before. And maybe his training had been more effective than he'd thought. He reached into his pocket and took out the yo-yo that Smithers had given him. There was a metal stud on the belt he was wearing, and he slammed the yo-yo against it, feeling it click into place, as it had been designed to. Then, as quickly as he could, he tied the end of the nylon cord round the bolt of the harpoon. Finally, he tucked the pistol he had taken from the guard into the back of his combats. He was ready. The plane had completed its pre-flight tests. It was facing down the runway. Its propellers were at full speed. Alex slammed the gears into first, released the handbrake, and gunned the jeep forward, shooting over the drive and onto the grass, heading for the airstrip. At the same time, there was a chatter of machine gun fire. He yanked down on the steering wheel and twisted away as his wing mirror exploded and a spray of bullets slammed into the windscreen and door. The two cars, speeding towards him, head-on, were getting closer and closer. Each of them had a guard in the back seat, leaning out of the window, firing at him. Alex swerved between them, and for a horrible second there was actually one on each side. He was sandwiched between the two cars, with guards firing at him left and right. But then he was through. The guards missed him and hit each other. He heard one of them yell out and drop his gun. One of the cars lost control and crashed into the front of the house, metalwork crumpling against brick. The other screeched to a halt, reversed, then came after him again. The plane had begun to move down the runway, slowly at first, but rapidly picking up speed. Alex hit the tarmac and followed. His foot was pressed down, the accelerator against the floor. The jeep was doing about 70, not fast enough. For just a few seconds, Alex was paralleled with the cargo plane, only a couple of meters from it. But already it was pulling ahead. At any moment it would be in the air. And straight ahead of him, the way was blocked. Two more jeeps had arrived on the runway. More guards with machine guns balanced themselves, half-crouching on the seats. Alex realized the only reason they weren't firing was that they were afraid of hitting the plane. But the plane had already left the ground. Ahead of him, and just to his left, Alex saw the front wheel separate itself from the runway. He glanced in his mirror. The car that had chased him from the house was right on his tail. He had nowhere left to go. One car behind him, two jeeps ahead of him, the plane now in the air, the back wheels lifting off. Everything happened at once. Alex let go of the steering wheel, grabbed the harpoon gun, and fired. The harpoon flashed through the air. The yo-yo attached to Alex's belt spun, trailing out 30 meters of specially designed advanced nylon. The pointed head of the harpoon buried itself in the underbelly of the plane. Alex felt himself almost being torn in half as he was yanked out of the jeep on the end of the cord. In seconds, he was 40, 50 meters above the runway, dangling underneath the plane. His jeep swerved out of control. The other two jeeps tried to avoid it, and failed. Both of them hit it in a three-way, head-on collision. There was an explosion, a ball of flame and a fist of gray smoke that followed Alex up, as if trying to snatch him back. A moment later, there was another explosion. The second car had tried to avoid the two jeeps, but it had been traveling too fast. It plowed into the burning wrecks, flipped over, and continued, screeching on its back along the runway, before it too burst into flames. Alex saw little of this. He was suspended from the plane by a single, thin, white cord, twisting round and round as he was carried ever further into the air. The wind was rushing past him, battering into his face and deafening him. He couldn't even hear the propellers just above his head. The belt was cutting into his waist. He could hardly breathe. Desperately, he scrabbled for the yo-yo and found the control he wanted, a single button. He pressed it. The tiny, powerful motor inside the yo-yo began to turn. The yo-yo rotated on his belt, pulling in the cord. Very slowly, a centimeter at a time, Alex was drawn up towards the plane. He had aimed the harpoon carefully. There was a door at the back of the plane, and when he turned off the engine mechanism in the yo-yo, he was close enough to reach out for its handle. He wondered who was flying the plane and where he was going. The pilot must have seen the destruction down on the runway, but he couldn't have heard the harpoon. He couldn't know he'd picked up an extra passenger. Opening the door was harder than he'd expected. He was still dangling under the plane, and every time he got close to the handle, the wind drove him back. He could still hardly see. The wind was tearing into his eyes. Twice his fingers found the metal handle, only to be pulled away before he could turn it. The third time, he managed to get a better grip, but it still took all his strength to yank the handle down. The door swung open, and he clambered into the hold. He took one last look back. The runway was already 300 meters below. There were two fires raging, but at this distance, they seemed no more than match heads. Alex unplugged the yo-yo, freeing himself. Then he reached to the waistband of his combats and took out the gun. The plane was empty, apart from a couple of bundles that Alex vaguely recognized. There was a single pilot at the controls, and something on his instrumentation must have told him the door was open because he suddenly twisted round. Alex found himself face to face with Mr. Grin.
What?
The butler muttered. Alex raised the gun. He doubted if he would have the courage to use it, but he wasn't going to let Mr. Grin know that.
All right, Mr. Grin,
he shouted above the noise of the propellers and the howl of the wind.
You may not be able to talk, but you'd better listen. I want you to fly this plane to London. We're going to the Science Museum in South Kensington. It can't take us more than half an hour to get there, and if you think about trying to trick me, I'll put a bullet in you. Do you understand?
Mr. Grin said nothing. Alex fired the gun. The bullet slammed into the floor just beside Mr. Grin's foot. Mr. Grin stared at Alex, then nodded slowly. He reached out and pulled the joystick. The plane dipped and began to head east. Chapter 16. 12 o'clock. London appeared. Suddenly the clouds rolled back and the midday sun brought the whole city shining into view. There was Battersea Power Station, standing proud with its four great chimneys still intact, even though much of its roof had long ago been eaten away. Behind it, Battersea Park appeared as a square of dense green bushes and trees that were making a last stand, fighting back the urban spread. In the far distance, the Millennium Wheel perched like a fabulous silver coin, balancing effortlessly on its rim. And all around it, London crouched, gas towers and apartment blocks, endless rows of shops and houses, roads, railways and bridges stretching away on both sides, separated only by the bright silver crack in the landscape that was the River Thames. Alex saw all this with a clenched stomach. Looking out through the open door of the aircraft, he'd had 50 minutes to think about what he had to do. 50 minutes while the plane droned over Cornwall and Devon, then Somerset and Salisbury Plains, before reaching the North Downs and flying on towards Windsor and London. When he had got into the plane, Alex had intended to use its radio to call the police or anyone else who might be listening. But seeing Mr. Grin at the controls had changed all that. He remembered how fast the man had been, both outside his bedroom and throwing the knife when Alex was handcuffed to the chair. He knew he was safe enough in the cargo area, with Mr. Grin strapped into the pilot seat at the front of the plane, but he didn't dare get any closer. Even with the gun, it would be too dangerous. He had thought of forcing Mr. Grin to land the plane at Heathrow. The radio had started squawking the moment they'd entered London airspace, and had only stopped when Mr. Grin turned it off. But that would never have worked. By the time they'd reached the airport, touched down and coasted to a halt, it would have been far too late. And then, sitting hunched up in the cargo area, Alex had recognized the two bundles lying on the floor next to him. They had told him exactly what he had to do.
Ugh,
Mr. Grin said. He twisted round in his seat, and for the last time Alex saw the hideous smile that the circus knife had torn through his cheeks. Thanks for the ride, Alex said, and jumped out of the open door. He was glad that he'd spent a day on parachute training with the SAS, although this flight had been even worse than the one he'd endured over the Welsh Valleys. This time there was no static line. There was no one to reassure him that his parachute was properly packed. If he could have thought of any other way to reach the Science Museum in the 7 minutes he had left, he would have taken it. There was no other way. He knew that. So he had jumped. Once he was over the threshold, it wasn't so bad. There was a moment of dizzying confusion as the wind hit him once again. He closed his eyes and forced himself to count to three. Pull too early and the parachute might snag on the plane's tail. Even so, his hand was clenched and he had barely muttered the word three before he was pulling with all his strength. The parachute blossomed open above him, and he was jerked back upwards, the harness cutting into his armpits and sides. They had been flying at 4,000 feet. When Alex opened his eyes, he was surprised by his sense of calm. He was dangling in the air, underneath a comforting canopy of white silk. He felt as if he wasn't moving at all. Now that he had left the plane, the city seemed even more distant and unreal. It was just him, the sky, and London. He was almost enjoying himself. And then he heard the plane coming back. It was already a couple of kilometers away, but even as he watched it, he saw it bank steeply to the right, making a sharp turn. The engines rose, and then it leveled out. It was heading straight towards him. Mr. Grin wasn't going to let him get away so easily. As the plane drew closer and closer, he could almost see the man's never-ending smile behind the window of the cockpit. Mr. Grin intended to steer the plane right into him, cut him to shreds in mid-air. But Alex had been expecting it. He reached down and took out the Game Boy. This time there was no game cartridge in it. But while he had been on the plane, he had taken out Bomber Boy and slid it across the floor. That was where it was now, just behind Mr. Grin's seat. He pressed the start button three times. Inside the plane, the cartridge exploded, releasing a cloud of acrid yellow smoke. The smoke billowed out through the hold, curling against the windows, trailing out of the open door. Mr. Grin vanished, completely surrounded by smoke. The plane wobbled, then plunged down. Alex watched the plane dive. He could imagine Mr. Grin blinded, fighting for control. The plane began to twist, slowly at first, then faster and faster. The engines whined. Now it was heading straight for the ground, howling through the sky. Yellow smoke trailed in its wake. At the last minute, Mr. Grin managed to bring the nose up again, but it was much too late. The plane smashed into what looked like a deserted piece of dockland near the river and disappeared in a ball of flame. Alex looked at his watch. 3 minutes to 12. He was still 1,000 feet in the air, and unless he landed on the very doorstep of the Science Museum, he wasn't going to make it. Grabbing hold of the cords, using them to steer himself, he tried to work out the fastest way down. Inside the East Hall of the Science Museum, Herod Sale was coming to the end of his speech. The entire chamber had been transformed for the great moment when the Stormbreakers would be brought online. The room was caught between old and new, between stone colonnades and stainless steel floors, between the very latest in high tech and old curiosities from the Industrial Revolution. A podium had been set up in the center for Sale, the Prime Minister, the Press Secretary, and the Minister of State for Education. In front of it were 12 rows of chairs, for journalists, teachers, invited friends. Alan Blunt was in the front row, as emotionless as ever. Mrs. Jones, dressed in black, with a large brooch on her lapel, was next to him. On either side of the hall, television towers had been constructed with cameras focusing in as Sale spoke. The speech was being broadcast live to schools throughout the country, and it would also be shown on the evening news. The hall was packed with another 200 or 300 people standing on first and second floor galleries, looking down on the podium from all sides. As Sale spoke, tape recorders turned and cameras flashed. Never before had a private individual made so generous a gift to the nation. This was an event. History in the making.
It is the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister alone, who is responsible for what is about to happen, Sale was saying. And I hope that tonight, when he reflects on what has happened today throughout this country, he will remember our days together at school, and everything he did at that time. I think tonight the country will know him for the man he is. One thing is sure. This is a day you will never forget.
He bowed. There was a scatter of applause. The Prime Minister glanced at his press secretary, puzzled. The press secretary shrugged with barely concealed rudeness. The Prime Minister took his place in front of the microphone.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to that, he joked, and all the journalists laughed.
The government had such a large majority that they knew it was in their best interests to laugh at the Prime Minister's jokes.
I'm glad Mr. Sale has such happy memories of our school days together, and I'm glad that the two of us, together, today, can make such a vital difference to our schools.
Herod Sale pointed at a table slightly to one side of the podium. On the table was a Stormbreaker computer, and next to it, a mouse.
This is the master control, he said. Click on the mouse and all the computers will come online.
Right.
The Prime Minister lifted his finger and adjusted his position so that the cameras could get his best profile. Somewhere outside the museum, a clock began to strike.
Alex heard the clock from about 300 feet, with the roof of the Science Museum rushing towards him. He had seen the building just after the plane had crashed. It hadn't been easy finding it, with the city spread out like a three-dimensional map right underneath him. On the other hand, he had lived his whole life in West London, and had visited the museum often enough. First he had seen the Victorian jelly mould that was the Albert Hall. Directly south of that was a tall white tower surmounted by a green dome. Imperial College. As Alex dropped, he seemed to be moving faster. The whole city had become a fantastic jigsaw puzzle, and he knew he had only seconds to piece it together. A wide, extravagant building with church-like towers and windows. That had to be the Natural History Museum. The Natural History Museum was on Cromwell Road. How did you get from there to the Science Museum? Of course, turn left at the lights up Exhibition Road, and there it was. Alex pulled at the parachute, guiding himself towards it. How small it looked compared to the other landmarks. A rectangular building with a flat grey roof jutting in from the main road. Part of the roof consisted of a series of arches, the sort of thing you might see on a railway station, or perhaps on an enormous conservatory. They were a dull orange in colour, curving one after the other. It looked as if they were made of glass. Alex could land on the flat part. Then all he would have to do was look through the curved windows. He still had the gun he had taken from the guard. He could use it to warn the Prime Minister. If he had to, he could use it to shoot Herod Sale. Somehow he managed to maneuver himself over the museum, but it was only as he fell the last 200 feet, as he heard the clock strike 12, that he realized two things. He was falling much too fast, and he had missed the flat roof. In fact, the Science Museum has two roofs. The original is Georgian and made of wired glass. But sometime in the recent past, it must have leaked, because the curators have constructed a second roof of plastic sheeting over the top. This was the orange roof that Alex had seen. He crashed into it feet first. The roof shattered. He continued straight through into an inner chamber, just missing a network of steel girders and maintenance ladders. He barely had time to register what looked like a brown carpet stretched out over the curving surface below. Then he hit it and tore through that too. It was no more than a thin cover, designed to keep the light and dust off the glass underneath. With a yell, Alex smashed through the glass. At last, his parachute caught on a beam. He jerked to a halt, swinging in midair inside the East Hall. This was what he saw. Far below him, all around him, 300 people had stopped and were staring up at him in shock. There were more people sitting on chairs directly underneath him, and some of them had been hit. There was blood and broken glass. A bridge made of green glass slats stretched across the hall. There was a futuristic information desk, and in front of it, at the very center of everything, was a makeshift stage. He saw the Stormbreaker first. Then, with a sense of disbelief, he recognized the Prime Minister standing, slack-jawed, next to Herod Sale. Alex hung in the air, dangling at the end of the parachute. As the last pieces of glass fell and disintegrated on the terracotta floor, movement and sound returned to the East Hall in an ever-widening wave. The security men were the first to react. Anonymous and invisible when they needed to be, they were suddenly everywhere, appearing from behind colonnades, from underneath the television towers, running across the green bridge, guns in hands that had been empty a second before. Alex had also drawn his gun, pulling it out from the waistband of his combats. Maybe he could explain why he was here before Sale or the Prime Minister activated the Stormbreakers. But he doubted it. Shoot first and ask questions later was a line from a bad film, but even bad films are sometimes right. He emptied the gun. The bullets echoed around the room, surprisingly loud. Now people were screaming, the journalists punching and pushing as they fought for cover. The first bullet went nowhere. The second hit the Prime Minister in the hand, his finger less than a centimeter away from the mouse. The third hit the mouse, blowing it into fragments. The fourth hit an electrical connection, smashing the plug and short-circuiting it. Sale had dived forward, determined to click on the mouse himself. The fifth and sixth bullets hit him. As soon as Alex had fired the last bullet, he dropped the gun, letting it clatter to the floor below, and held up the palms of his hands. He felt ridiculous, hanging there from the roof, his arms outstretched. but there were already a dozen guns pointing at him, and he had to show them he was no longer armed, that they didn't need to shoot. Even so, he braced himself, waiting for the security men to open fire. He could almost imagine the hail of bullets tearing into him. As far as they were concerned, he was some sort of crazy terrorist who had just parachuted into the science museum and had taken 6 shots at the Prime Minister. It was their job to kill him. It was what they'd been trained for. But the bullets never came. All the security men were equipped with radio headsets, and in the front row, Mrs. Jones had control. The moment she had recognized Alex, she had spoken urgently into her brooch.
Don't shoot! Repeat, don't shoot! Await my command!
On the podium, a plume of gray smoke rose out of the back of the broken, useless Stormbreaker. 2 security men had rushed to the Prime Minister, who was clutching his wrist, blood dripping from his hand. Journalists had begun to shout questions. Photographers, cameras were flashing, and the television cameras, too, had been swung round to focus in on the figure swaying high above. More security men were moving to seal off the exits, following orders from Mrs. Jones, while Alan Blunt looked on, for once in his life, out of his depth. But there was no sign of Herod Sale. The head of Sale Enterprises had been shot 2 times. But somehow, he had disappeared. Chapter 17. Yassin.
You slightly spoiled things by shooting the Prime Minister, Alan Blunt said. But all in all, you're to be congratulated, Alex. You not only lived up to our expectations, you far exceeded them.
It was late afternoon the following day, and Alex was sitting in Blunt's office at the Royal and General Building on Liverpool Street, wondering just why, after everything he had done for them, the head of MI6 had to sound quite so much like a second-rate public school headmaster giving him a good report. Mrs. Jones was sitting next to him. Alex had refused her offer of a peppermint, although he was beginning to realize it was all the reward he was going to get. She spoke now for the first time since he'd come into the room.
You might like to know about the clearing-up operation.
Sure. She glanced at Blunt, who nodded.
First of all, don't expect to read the truth about any of this in the newspapers, she began. We put a D-notice on it, which means nobody is allowed to report what happened. Of course, the ceremony at the Science Museum was being televised live, but fortunately, we were able to cut transmission before the cameras could focus on you. In fact, nobody knows that it was a 14-year-old boy who caused all the chaos.
And we plan to keep it that way, Blunt muttered.
Why?
Alex didn't like the sound of that.
Mrs. Jones dismissed the question. The newspapers had to print something, of course, she went on. The story we've put out is that Sale was attacked by a hitherto unknown terrorist organization, and that he's gone into hiding.
Where is Sale? Alex asked.
We don't know, but we'll find him. There's nowhere on earth he can hide from us.
Okay, Alex sounded doubtful.
As for the Stormbreakers, we've already announced that there's a dangerous product fault and that anyone turning them on could get electrocuted. It's embarrassing for the government, of course, but they've all been recalled, and we're bringing them in now. Fortunately, Sale was so fanatical that he programmed them so that the smallpox virus could only be released by the Prime Minister at the Science Museum. You managed to destroy the trigger, so even the few schools that have tried to start up their computers haven't been affected.
It was very close, Blunt said. We've analyzed a couple of samples. It's lethal. Worse even than the stuff Iraq was brewing up in the Gulf War.
Do you know who supplied it? Alex asked.
Blunt coughed. No.
The submarine I saw was Chinese.
And that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It was obvious that Blunt didn't want to talk about it. You can just be sure that we'll make all the necessary inquiries.
What about Yassin Grigorovich? Alex asked.
Mrs. Jones took over.
We've closed down the plant at Port Talon, she said. We already have most of the personnel under arrest. Unfortunately, we weren't able to talk to either Nadia Vola or the man you knew as Mr. Grin.
He never talked much anyway, Alex said.
It was lucky that his plane crashed into a building site, Mrs. Jones went on. Nobody else was killed. As for Yassin, I imagine he'll disappear. From what you've told us, it's clear that he wasn't actually working for Sale. He was working for the people who were sponsoring Sale. And I doubt they'll be very pleased with him. Yassin is probably on the other side of the world already. But one day, perhaps, we'll find him. We'll never stop looking.
There was a long silence. It seemed that the two spymasters had said all they wanted. But there was one question that nobody had tackled. "What happens to me?" Alex asked.
"You go back to school," Blunt replied.
Mrs. Jones took out an envelope and handed it to Alex. "A check?" he asked. "It's a letter from a doctor explaining that you've been away for 3 weeks with flu. Very bad flu. If anyone asks, he's a real doctor. You shouldn't have any trouble."
"You'll continue to live in your uncle's house," Blunt said. "That housekeeper of yours, Jack whatever, she'll look after you. And that way we'll know where you are if we need you again."
Need you again? The words chilled Alex more than anything that had happened to him in the past 3 weeks.
"You've got to be kidding," he said.
"No,"
Blunt gazed at him quite coolly.
"It's not my habit to make jokes."
"You've done very well, Alex,"
Mrs. Jones said, trying to sound more conciliatory.
"The Prime Minister himself asked us to pass on his thanks to you, and the fact of the matter is that it could be wonderfully useful to have someone as young as you..."
"As talented as you," Blunt cut in.
"Available to us from time to time."
She held up a hand to ward off any argument.
"Let's not talk about it now," she said. "But if ever another situation arises, perhaps we can get in touch then."
"Yeah, sure." Alex looked from one to the other. These weren't people who were going to take no for an answer. In their own way, they were both as charming as Mr. Grin.
"Can I go?" he asked.
"Of course you can," Mrs. Jones said. "Would you like someone to drive you home?"
"No, thanks," Alex got up. "I'll find my own way." He should have been feeling better. As he took the lift down to the ground floor, he reflected that he'd saved thousands of schoolchildren. He'd beaten Herod's sale, and he hadn't been killed or even badly hurt. So what was there to be unhappy about? The answer was simple. Blunt had forced him into this. In the end, the big difference between him and James Bond wasn't a question of age. It was a question of loyalty. In the old days, spies had done what they'd done because they loved their country, because they believed in what they were doing. But he'd never been given a choice. Nowadays, spies weren't employed. They were used. He came out of the building, meaning to walk up to the tube station, but just then a cab drove along and he flagged it down. He was too tired for public transport. He glanced at the driver, huddled over the wheel in a horribly knitted homemade cardigan, and slumped onto the back seat.
"Cheyne Walk, Chelsea," Alex said.
The driver turned round. He was holding a gun. His face was paler than it had been the last time Alex saw it, and the pain of two bullet wounds was drawn all over it. But, impossibly, it was Herod Sale.
"If you move, you bloody child, I will shoot you,"
Sale said. His voice was pure venom.
"If you try anything, I will shoot you. Sit still. You're coming with me."
The doors clicked shut, locking automatically. Herod Sale turned round and drove off, down Liverpool Street, heading for the city. Alex didn't know what to do. He was certain that Sale planned to shoot him anyway. Why else would he have taken the huge chance of driving up to the very door of MI6 headquarters in London? He thought about trying the window, perhaps trying to get the attention of another car at a traffic light. But it wouldn't work. Sale would turn round and kill him. The man had nothing left to lose. They drove for 10 minutes. It was a Saturday and the city was closed. The traffic was light. Then Sale pulled up in front of a modern glass-fronted skyscraper with an abstract sculpture, two oversized bronze walnuts on a slab of concrete outside the front door.
"You will get out of the car with me," Sale commanded. "You and I will walk into the building. If you think about running, remember that this gun is pointed at your spine."
Sale got out of the car first. His eyes never left Alex. Alex guessed that the two bullets must have hit him in the left arm and shoulder. His left hand was hanging limp, but the gun was in his right hand. It was perfectly steady, aimed at Alex's lower back.
"In."
The building had swing doors, and they were open. Alex found himself in a marble-clad hall with leather sofas and a curving reception desk. There was nobody here, either. Sale gestured with the gun, and Alex walked over to a bank of lifts. One of them was waiting. They got in.
The 29th floor, Sale said.
Alex pressed the button.
Are we going up for the view? He asked.
Sale nodded.
You make all the bloody jokes you want, he said, but I'm going to have the last laugh.
They stood in silence. Alex could feel the pressure in his ears as the lift rose higher and higher. Sale was staring at him, his damaged arm tucked into his side, supporting himself against the door. Alex thought about attacking him. If he could just get the element of surprise. But no, they were too close, and Sale was coiled up like a spring. The lift slowed down and the doors opened. Sale waved the gun.
Turn left. You'll come to a door. Open it.
Alex did as he was told. The door was marked helipad. A flight of concrete steps led up. Alex glanced at Sale. Sale nodded.
Up!
They climbed the steps and reached another door with a push bar. Alex pressed it and went through. He was back outside, 30 floors up, on a flat roof with a radio mast and a tall metal fence running round the perimeter. He and Sale were standing on the edge of a huge cross painted in red. Looking round, Alex could see right across the city to Canary Wharf. It had seemed a quiet spring day when Alex left the Royal and General offices, but up here the wind streaked past and the clouds boiled.
You ruined everything, Sale howled. How did you do it? How did you trick me? I'd have beaten you if you'd been a man, but they had to send a boy, a bloody schoolboy. Well, it isn't over yet. I'm leaving England, do you see?
Sale nodded, and Alex turned to see that there was a helicopter hovering in the air behind him. Where had it come from? It was red and yellow, a light, single-engine aircraft with a figure in dark glasses and helmet hunched over the controls. The helicopter was a Colibri EC-120B, one of the quietest in the world. It swung round over him, its blades beating at the air.
That's my ticket out of here, Sale continued. They'll never find me. And one day I'll be back. Next time, nothing will go wrong, and you won't be here to stop me. This is the end for you. This is where you die.
There was nothing Alex could do. Sale raised the gun and took aim. His eyes wide, the pupils blacker than they'd ever been, mere pinpricks in the bulging whites. There were two small, explosive cracks. Alex looked down, expecting to see blood. There was nothing. He couldn't feel anything. Then Sale staggered and fell onto his back. There were two gaping holes in his chest. The helicopter landed at the center of the cross. Yasin Grigorovich got out. Still holding the gun that had killed Herod Sale, he walked over and examined the body, prodding it with his shoe. Satisfied, he nodded to himself, tucking the gun away. He had switched off the engine of the helicopter, and behind him the blades slowed down and stopped. Alex stepped forward. Yasin seemed to notice him for the first time.
You're Yasin Grigorovich, Alex said.
The Russian nodded. It was impossible to tell what was going on in his head. His clear blue eyes gave nothing away.
Why did you kill him?
Alex asked. Those were my instructions. There was no trace of an accent in his voice. He spoke softly, reasonably. He'd become an embarrassment. It was better this way.
Not better for him?
Yasin shrugged.
What about me?
Alex asked. The Russian ran his eyes over Alex, as if weighing him up. I have no instructions concerning you, he said.
You're not going to shoot me too?
Do I have any need to? There was a pause. The two of them gazed at each other over the corpse of Herod Sale.
You killed Ian Ryder, Alex said. He was my uncle.
Yasin shrugged. I kill a lot of people. One day I'll kill you. A lot of people have tried. Yasin smiled. Believe me, he said. It would be better if we didn't meet again. Go back to school.
Go back to your life, and the next time they ask you, say no. Killing is for grown-ups, and you're still a child.
He turned his back on Alex and climbed into the helicopter cabin. The blade started up, and a few seconds later the helicopter rose back into the air. For a moment, it hovered at the side of the building. Behind the glass, Yasin raised his hand. A gesture of friendship? A salute? Alex raised his hand. The helicopter spun away. Alex stood where he was, watching it, until it had disappeared in the dying light.
This is Nathaniel Parker. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Stormbreaker by Anthony Horowitz. This program was directed by Ken Ross. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2001 by Anthony Horowitz. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment. It's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Thank you, and happy listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.